Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Lorenzen. Because I work in art, my Instagram feed is full of images labeled with the hashtag #artiswork. The sentiment these tags convey is perhaps uncontroversial, but the history of art's relationship to labor is complex and far from stable. Well, Working Aesthetics, Labor, Art and Capitalism, which is a recent book by Danielle Child, traces this history and explores the critical potential of thinking about art as labor. Danielle Child is Senior Lecturer in Art History at Manchester School of Art, and I'm very happy that she joins me now to talk about her work. Welcome to the show, Dani.
Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Before we get into the book itself, it would be great to give our listeners an idea of how you arrived at your subject matter.
So my interest in art and labour actually goes back to my undergraduate studies. So I studied art history at the University of Leeds, and I stayed there to do my master's and my PhD as well. And while studying on my undergraduate, my BA at History of Art, I realised that there were other people who made works of art for artists. So it wasn't just the artist in the studio on their own making works, but that there were other employed workers, assistants, and later I discovered the fabricators who were making works of art for artists. And one of the things that kind of drove my interest is that I really wondered why these people weren't being spoken about within art history. That in many ways these workers were invisible in the dominant narratives of art history. And I should also say that I come to this subject from a kind of a personal perspective as well, in that I come from a working class background. My father was a manual worker. He was a mechanic. And so my interest in thinking about where the kind of workers are in these histories, this kind of obfuscation of the workers, was kind of driven by obviously my history of coming, being around workers and thinking about class and identity within this. So I wanted to know more, and I wanted to make them visible. So by the time I got to PhD, and obviously then developing that research for the book, I was really quite interested in figuring out or discovering who these workers are and how they work and how that sits in relation to the kind of the wider economic conditions and those of capitalism. So, my research even now, after publishing the book, is still around class and working conditions and labour and how this manifests within artistic practice. And a key thing within the book and within my my contemporary research as well is about this visible, invisible dichotomy. You know, at what point are the workers being made visible within contemporary art practice?
Well, class and labour are definitely protagonists in the book. And you open the volume beautifully with a reproduction of a 1874 painting by Aircrow, which shows a group of women in a street in Wigan in Northern England. And this painting hangs in Manchester Art Gallery in the city where you are now. And you remark on the fact that the 19th century criticism of this work centered on not the art itself, not the painting, but rather the general unsuitability of the subjects, the working class women, which are depicted in it. So this seems to be like a very good way to get into the long and twisted and quite difficult relationship between art and history and labour.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book starts in the 1960s. And I should say that its main focus is the contemporary, but this opening chapter really starts at this point in which what's known as the de-skilling thesis, which was made popular by thinkers like Harry Braverman in the 1970s, where this de-skilling of work begins to kind of manifest under capitalism. So where, I guess, historically craft-based skills embedded in manual work begin to be fragmented. Conditions like Fordism or economic working models like Fordism, in which the assembly line's introduced and work is made piecemeal, and the worker just gets to undertake one small part of a larger process of work. So I look at this moment in which these skills are being fragmented in relation to the emergence of art fabrication firms in the US that are solely kind of dedicated to fabricating works of art for artists. So firms like Lippincott Inc., who are the main case study for this first chapter, but also Carlson & Co. as well. And these are fabrication firms who are employed by artists to make large-scale sculpture. So the work that you of the minimalists and artists like Clay Soldenberg, these kind of works have been fabricated by these art factories, if you like.
Well, you do give a sense of the mismatch between the ideas of minimalism and the factory scale of the productions.
The first chapter really focuses on this moment and brings us up to the 1990s, where Lippincott Inc. Adapt their working practice. So they, if memory serves correct, they get rid of their kind of their physical fabrication site, and they begin to subcontract to other companies. So their working practice shifts from one where everything's kind of made on site to one which utilizes the knowledge of people like Donald Lippincott, who was the head of Lippincott Inc., and used his networks and his knowledge to be able to meet with artists and kind of discuss their needs and then contract out certain bits of work depending on what kind of skills need to be employed. And so the second chapter picks up this moment in the around the 1990s and moves to London to look at the emergence of the Mike Smith Studio, which is a kind of fabrication company, but that bills itself as a facilitators rather than fabricators. So you've got this kind of this shift in terminology from, you know, one that's aligned with making to one that's aligned with kind of assisting, which I think is quite important, because while in the US the fabrication companies like Carlson & Co. are kind of are reformulating how they work and realigning their practices with one that's contracting outwork, and especially with Lippincott Inc., Mike Smith Studio is developing this business model that has that from the kind of outset in some ways. And really this chapter kind of focuses on how this works in tandem with the establishment of neoliberalism in the UK. So a kind of a very kind of specific form of it, and looking at David Harvey's ideas of flexible accumulation, and this shift to a mode of working that's about kind of flexible work, part-time, subcontracting, and how the economic conditions allow for a studio like the Maximi Studio to be able to emerge and kind of flourish under these new conditions. And within this as well is the figure of Mike Smith as this this project manager, who I read in terms of Luke Boltanski and Eve Chiapello's Great Man in the Projective City from their book The New Spirit of Capitalism. So I read it again against these kind of these changes within managerial and business models. And there's a kind of an understanding that without Mike Smith, the studio wouldn't be what it is. His knowledge that kind of makes the studio and sustains it.
Well, so we've cleared along from the idea of a fabricator to a facilitator and a producer in a mere couple of decades.
And then the third chapter takes us to looking at the model or the figure of the project manager, but in the artist within that role. So I look at the artist Thomas Hersham, who is a well-known artist who engages in making kind of material objects, but also these projects, which are kind of socially engaged, fixed duration projects in sites that are often away from the always away from the gallery space, and kind of tangentially linked to art fairs or, you know, kind of sponsorship by, say, the Gramsci Monuments, Deer Art Foundation fund it. And so I kind of consider the artist in this role of project manager. What happens when Thomas Hersham becomes the person who's bringing together these networks and managing work that takes place in building and bringing together these monuments, which have a number of moving parts, whether it's building libraries and snack bars and holding poetry readings and events and open mic nights, and they all take place with the local inhabitants of, and they're often on housing estates with people from kind of mixed ethnic backgrounds. So he doesn't want to make these works necessarily for an art audience. He's interested in engaging the people who live in these communities to build these projects. So I also read him in tandem with the ideas coming out of the New Spirit of Capitalism as well, thinking about how Hersham exists as this autonomous artist whose work is subsumed under his singular name, but it's about facilitating these projects that include many hands and many workers who are paid to help build and realise these projects. So the first three chapters are kind of based around making, I guess kind of loosely, but you've got these two kind of the fabricator, the facilitator, and the project manager. And the final three chapters tend to look at more immaterial skills. And we're already moving into immaterial skills with project management and building networks and knowledge. But within chapter four, I turn to look at immaterial labour and the labour of the call centre. So the case study in chapter four is Ramini Protocol's Calcutta in a Box, which is a one-to-one phone play. So it's a play that takes place over the telephone between one participant and one actor. But the actor is playing themselves. So but as a worker in a call centre, and they're based in Calcutta in India. it's a play that kind of reveals through conversation kind of assumptions, and it's often it's predominantly Western audiences. So the play has been performed at a number of different kind of performance festivals over the years. So you've often got this kind of revelation of people's assumptions about the call center workers in India. And throughout the play, this is kind of revealing. You get to see the worker, you might dance with them by the end of it, you share a cup of tea. And all these different kind of aspects unfold. And I read this against the shift to immaterial labour within, again, under neoliberalism, within contemporary capitalism, and how these plays work in tandem with this image, because the worker, the actor, is being employed to perform, which is pretty much exactly what happens in a normal call center exchange.
Certainly.
So that, you know, there's this kind of moment of, I guess, making us think about this. Well, first of all, the global displacement of labor, you know, thinking about these call centers that are at the other side of the world, again, serving a Western audience. But also just thinking about what that work is, you know, where are the differences, and where is it aligned through being employed to talk to someone with a script, just like you would under normal kind of call center circumstances as well. But it also subverts that relationship by having a real kind of personal conversation with the person on the other end of the call, the viewer. So, it's a really complex, kind of interesting set of ideas to unpack. But that, again, as I say, is read against immaterial labour. So I start to look at theory from kind of post-autonomia, Italian thinkers, and also people like Michael Hart as well, and Paolo Vieno, and unpack these ideas. And this is taken through to chapter 5. In which I look at the kind of the performative qualities of effective labour, which is another form of immaterial labour, in relation to the art activism of Liberate Tate. And I read a couple of their works. And really, in terms of thinking about Timepiece, which was a piece that was performed, enacted in the Turbine Hall in Tate Modern, thinking about how that space of the Turbine Hall is kind of a public space. It's open to anyone to enter, and how that kind of allows for this unsanctioned performance to take place. And I read this through thinking about the idea of the virtuoso, again from Paolo Vieno's writings, and the virtuoso was historically aligned with the politician. So thinking about that kind of how Liberate Tate reappropriate or realign the political with the performative in order to undertake these very kind of political actions that are asking for Tate to end their relationship with BP as a sponsor of the galleries. And so I read these works as also being able to take place because they look like the other things that would happen in the Turbine Hall. So a visitor to Tate Modern isn't sure if it's sanctioned or not. And they have, Liberate Tate had this interesting relationship with the Tate. So when they tried to gift a propeller from a wind turbine to the Tate in one of their performances called The Gift, Tate refused the gift, but they kept the documentation, and it's in the Tate archive. So there's that real interesting relationship with Tate and Liberate Tate as well. They've not rejected them as kind of activists who come and disrupt their space. They, you know, by, you know, what does that mean to take the documentation and place it in the archive in the space that they're undertaking these actions?
Well, we seem to have gone full circle from the industrial specularities of Lippincott's fabrications in times of minimalism to the industrial spectacular of a wind turbine at Tate now. But you end the book with an example of a practice that is far less material than either of these, and an example that's a little bit closer to what's happening in the news at the moment.
The final chapter then moves on again to another group who have been engaged in activism in the digital realm, which is eToy, and I look at digital labour. So I should say that each chapter takes a model of labour and a case study, and reads the case study in relation to this model of labour that's contemporaneous to the moment in which these works are taking place. So with chapter six, we move on to the digital, and I revisit the idea of the neutrality of machinery under capitalism, which is something that comes out of Marx's fragment on machines and is then taken up by Raniero Panzieri in, I think, in the 1960s, I think it's 64, where he takes up this idea and talks about the kind of the capitalist use of technology. So in this final chapter, I look at eToy's early kind of hacktivist action, the toy war. But I also look at a work on Mission Eternity, which is a really complicated work to to try and explain. It's described as a digital postmortem. And it's effectively where you would sign up to have this kind of digital record of your life, kind of saved for eternity. And then there are material aspects of this where there's a kind of a performative aspect of it where part of after death, part of the human remains are made into an object. The actual digital content is actually held across many different sites. So it's a peer-to-peer form of networking, which is something that we might elaborate on a little later in relation to the kind of recent shifts in digital artwork that have kind of come about in the last few months. So this last chapter really starts to think about how certain digital forms of labour can actually overcome or avoid becoming part of capitalism, or avoiding that kind of system that creates profit, which I think happens with this peer-to-peer practice that eToy are engaged in.
Well, Danny, thank you. This is quite a tour de force. Thank you so much. And for me, who's someone who's not an art historian and who works in the contemporary, it's particularly interesting to see in so much vivid detail the story of the fabricators and the facilitators. Again, the 1960s, which seemed to be a turning point for so many things and artistic practices and ways of thinking about artistic production, never fails to amaze me how things happen in the US 20 or 30 years ahead of us here in the UK. So I want to use this example to ask you about the relationship between the availability of technologies and then the demand for those technologies being used in artistic production, which to me seems to mirror the idea of capitalism exploiting certain material possibilities, but also being shaped by them.
I get this chicken and egg question. I'm not sure if I want to offer a concrete answer to that. I mean, for for me, within the way that that I view artistic practice, the development of artistic practice, I always read things against the economic, you know, what's happening. I don't think that art exists in this kind of separate sphere away from everything that happens in quote unquote real life. So, I mean, I guess for me, this process of de-skilling within dominant work is occurring at the same time that artists are moving away from painting. And particularly within the US, we have, you know, the 1960s is this point of high modernism where, particularly within art criticism, with someone like Clement Greenberg, you've reached this saturation point of what modernist painting is, and it's been reduced to these cardinal norms, you know, flatness, opticality, all these kind of things that we now kind of reduce Greenberg's writings to. And artists begin to respond to that. They don't necessarily want to be painters anymore. You know, someone like Alan Kaprow, who reads, you know, the legacy of Jackson Pollock, where he reads kind of performances coming out of Pollock, is this kind of this tipping point, I think, for artists to begin to spread that into the, you know, what Krauss has called the expanded field, I guess. And so within this shift, you've got the emergence of minimalism, which is often read as this response to a Greenbergian modernism where sculptors begin to think about, I guess, what makes sculpture sculpture? What are the qualities, just as Greenberg did with painting, what are the qualities that make painting paint, solely painting, two-dimensionality, and all these things, you know, within these debates within Art Forum, you know, with Donald Judd and Specific Objects, and Andre, Carl Andre gets involved as well with, and Robert Morris, you get this moment in which sculpture starts to kind of turn into objects and think about what is it about sculpture that makes it exclusively sculpture. And I think minimalism comes out of this. So that within this, there's an eradication of the artist's hand, of gesture. And so the employment of a fabricator then further distances the artist from the making of their work. But I mean, there's also within this, there's also the question of scale. So at this point, public sculpture becomes larger in scale. And so practically, a single artist cannot manufacture a large scale piece of work out of metal on their own. And there are all these skills that you need to do that, such as welding and, you know, whatever else. So when Lipping got in commerged, it was to facilitate this, this fabrication of these large scale kind of public works that were going to be often sited outdoors. And within Lippincott Inc., there's also this, I've forgotten how they frame it, like land in which these works can also be kind of displayed, like a showroom, like an outdoor showroom.
So it's a very, very weird setup for its time, as I understand. So they have both a sculpture garden, they produce the work, they display the work, presumably with a view to sell it or place it somewhere. But they also do something that we're quite used to seeing with blue chip contemporary art galleries now, which is that they quite often finance the production. In what you said, I'm interested in what to me seems a bit like a paradox. So in this break with history that results in de-skilling, there's a moment in which the artist no longer has the skills, no longer has the knowledge to produce the kind of work that they want to produce. But in a kind of classic Marxist economic reading of artistic labor as being unproductive, one of the benefits of not trying to be productive is that it creates artistic autonomy. But I'm seeing a paradox in the fact that the artist doesn't want to be productive anymore, yet ends up relying very quickly on these massive mechanisms of incorporated manufacturers, their financing, the workshops and so on and so on.
I mean, first of all, just to go back to unproductive labour, the only thing that's not being produced in that understanding is profit. The artist, I guess, is still producing things, but they're just not a wage labourer. They're not employed to producing, so they're freely producing in that sense. In terms of the knowledge, I think one of the things that I say in the book is that you have this shift from kind of artistic skills in this moment of de-skilling and employing fabricators to managerial skills. So I recall this kind of the production of a Claes Oldenburg work within Lippincott Inc., where he sits on this chair that they've put a label kind of director or something on the back of the chair, and you know, he's kind of meant in jest, but he's also sat there overseeing the production of these works. And so what role does the artist take then in that? They're managing, they're overseeing. They still have that control as to say, I want the patina to be more shiny, or you know, to make those decisions. So the craft based knowledge remains with the employed workers, and I don't think that the artist is de-skilled in that they in a kind of a negative sense. But that there's that shift to a kind of a managerial skills. And I know that John Roberts touches on this in Intangibilities of Form, when he talks about this kind of this reskilling into immaterial skills. And he never really qualifies that, because he's not necessarily writing about immaterial labour in the contemporary period. But I think through my book, you can see at these points where the artist's knowledge is changing from one from handicraft production through to, I mean, to the very end, to digital skills, and thinking about, you know, learning the digital. But within that, you've got the performative, you've got the project management, you've got the networking. You know, in a figure like Thomas Hirshhorn, his skills are very much within the way that he interacts with people and the way that he kind of facilitates these projects and goes into these communities. And he, with the Gramsci Monument, I think it was like 40 plus projects that he visited in New York until he found the people who understood that he wasn't going to go in there and do social work, but that he was saying to them, I want to do this project. Do you want to work with me to make this? And I think there's something within the kind of the personal skills and of the artist that facilitates that project. It's not about whether or not he's got the ability to build shacks, you know, on housing estates. There's something different there. It's about how do you bring people together and get them to work without friction, or if there is friction, how do you deal with that? How is that resolved? So I think the artist's skills have shifted from one which is tied to the hand to one which is very much tied to knowledge. And this is mirrored in the way that capitalist work has kind of transmuted into the contemporary, where we've had this shift to the service industries, to effective labour, to immaterial skills. So, you know, kind of dominant models of work and, you know, in the West predominantly have shifted to these ones that are aligned with knowledge now rather than handcraft.
But I think a good example is in your second chapter, which is the Mike Smith Studio. It's kind of a successor of Lippincott Inc. But in the UK, Mike Smith is a fabricator, first artist and fabricator to the whole generation of YBAs, young British artists. But for me, what's interesting about Mike Smith's studio is that the studio is the kind of temple, even more so than with Lippincott. Like it's almost that the fabricator here leads the production. You describe Mike Smith as the person who who comes up with everything. So there is a kind of danger to all of this when the artist lets go of whatever knowledge area they've carved out for themselves. They are automatically at the mercy of the collaborators.
In thinking about the Mike Smith Studio, you're absolutely right. I mean, a couple of times, I think, in the chapter, I cite from artists who have worked with Smith that basically say, if something happens to this studio, British art won't look the same. There's a polished aesthetic that accompanies Mike Smith Studio that once you've spent time looking at the works or the artists with whom he's worked, you can start to identify it.
It's quite surprising how many, you know, household names that the studio has worked with. And we've got Rachel Whiteread, we have Mona Hatoum and countless others. Anyhow, I think it would be interesting to move into chapter 4 and your discussion of Rimini Protocols Calcutta in a box, which you've already alluded to. It's an incredibly complicated project, which involves commissioning a call center in India and performances.
I think the thing that's important for me about this chapter is about making visible the worker. You know, this idea that runs through the book, particularly with call center work, which, you know, is a phone call is something that happens orally, that, you know, you don't see the worker, you're normally undertaking a transaction, you're trying to get off the phone as quick as possible. And what Call Culture in a Box does is it forces you for almost an hour to have one of these phone calls. And there are so many really kind of clever devices that are written into the script in order to make visible the working practices of the call center. So at one point, there's something like the actor worker coughs. And they say something like, oh, sorry, I'm eating a sweet. It's against the rules for us to do this. And through that device, you know, the rules of the call center are then kind of divulged to the person on the other end of the phone. And it just exposes the kind of the conditions of labor within these call centers. You find out that the other call center workers who are employed as actual call center workers and not play performers are working on different timescales. So they're speaking to people in Australia and the United States, I think. So they, you know, there's this whole kind of, you realize that these are people on the other side of the world who are working during nighttime when you're talking to them during daytime. There's just a lot of really clever kind of devices that are built into this play to expose these real conditions of labor whilst making it a kind of a casual conversation. There are prompts, there are questions that the call center worker asks the viewer, the participant. But really on the script, it says something like the main aim is really just to have a conversation. You're not really interested about selling, the audience member something. It's about having this conversation and getting to know the person on the other end of the phone better. And there's one particular bit that I like where the worker shares an image and they say something like, oh, who do you think this is? And obviously the audience member is meant to think that the image is the worker. And there's a further revelation that this is actually a domestic worker employed by the call center worker in the home. And suddenly those kind of the class-based assumptions are again kind of shifted. So you have another model of labor that the call center worker employs a domestic worker in the home, and that then the domestic worker is revealed. And you know, there's just like these kind of loads of ways in which work is made visible without naming it through the play, which I think is really interesting. And this is all done through the same format of that the call center work, the typical call center work would employ.
I think what's really interesting in this example is that we've really moved 360 degrees because it's now not the artist necessarily producing the labor. The artist is shining light on the labor. But how do these kind of modes of labor transfer critically into how we think about artistic labor?
So Rimini Protocol is interesting in that they're a collective of directors. So they're not artists in, they're not visual artists or in that sense. So I've sidestepped in this chapter to look at performance a bit more because I think this is interesting. So, you know, their work is very much in the conception, in the writing. I guess I don't really talk about this in the book in relation to this case study, but your prompt has made me think that the labor that happens here by Rimini Protocol is, again, knowledge work. It's immaterial, it's knowledge production again, it's research, it's script writing, it's finding places to work with. So the call center worker on the other end of the phone is based at a company called Descon Limited, which is a real call center. And whilst they're performing for theatre goers, they're in a call center with people who are working for other companies who are not doing theatre work. And that relationship has to be, you know, negotiated as well. Where do we cite the actors? Who do we work with? How does this relationship work? And I guess that's all those skills belong to the artist as facilitators, I guess, of these new practices. So, you know, even in thinking about relational aesthetics, the artist's skills are shifting to immaterial skills at this point. If we think about, you know, Recruiter of Veneer, cooking pieces, cooking in the gallery, or the director's skills here are in this kind of conception and this writing of these scripts and this reworking. So every iteration is slightly different as well.
An aspect of Rimini Protocol's work, which I think takes us neatly towards the end of the book, with in which you look at Ito's practice, is the role of technology in shaping labor and our relationships with other people and relationships with labor. So I wonder if, in a slightly unfair way, I could ask you to take us through the evolution of what one might naively think is new technology, starting with the practice of Ito in the 90s and the early 2000s, and maybe taking us to some of the implications of a recent technological, I'm not entirely sure whether it's a utopia or a dystopia that we're living in.
Yeah, so Ito's kind of early work starts in the 1990s, obviously with the advent of the internet. So they're kind of utilizing digital skills and I guess things like coding to, first of all, engage in this form of hacktivism with the toy war that I briefly talk about in this final chapter. But then they move on in 2005 to create Mission Eternity, which is, as I already mentioned, this kind of digital post-mortem that exists. That they produce for people who sign up to be part of the project. So one of the things that I think is really interesting about Mission Eternity and the kind of the digital labor is that it's dispersed, that the labor is all or is often done by anonymous workers who sign up to participate in the project and offer their kind of their digital labor to the project. So this happens in a kind of a peer-to-peer process in which if you sign up, you dedicate something like at least 15 megabytes of space and you download the program that runs in the background of your computer. and this holds some of the information, and some information is held on someone else's unit, et cetera, et cetera. And so all this kind of this digital information is dispersed, and it relies on people continuing to presumably run these programs in order for it to keep going. All the software is open source and freely available, so there's no kind of financial implication for someone offering this space. So it's eToy and a not-for-profit organization, so they run as a corporation, but it's not-for-profit. And in this chapter, I kind of suggest that they somehow bypass the kind of the capitalist economic system, or they avoid the capitalist process, which is always about profit, in employing this peer-to-peer practice. And I think in the contemporary that this kind of employment of peer-to-peer type models has now become somehow subsumed by capitalism. So
we could have expected that, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think it's cyclical, isn't it? Because I guess within the book we see how these economic models are either appropriated by artists or inspired by artists, so this dialectical relationship. We've come to a point now, you know, outside, beyond the book, where we have blockchain technology being employed to value and monetize digital artworks. And I've only just started to think about this, and I need to think about it more carefully. But already with the non-fungible tokens being employed in these high value works of art, I'm thinking about the Benjaminian aura, and what that means, how we might rethink, I guess, the work of art in digital reproduction. You know, and how can a digital work of art be unique?
Well, I'm going to quote a tweet from someone who I think works at Christie's to suggest that the aura has transferred now to the transaction itself, which I think is a fantastic way to kind of leave us with a conundrum. And I wonder if I can ask you to speculate even further. We just talked about NFTs and the conundrum that they are going to pose. So not assuming that this is your area of research, it would be great to hear where your work is taking you now.
So my current work is returning back to ideas of class. So I've been working on thinking about working class identity within contemporary art as well. And returning to works like Tracy Emin's Why I Never Became a Dancer video from the mid-1990s, which is based in Margate and looking at the history of Margate in relation to Emin's working class identity and how that's embedded within the video.
Last and third question. Do you think the pandemic tests these ideas in any particular way, or changes how we should think about artistic labors? Of course, we're in a situation where most of the world's creative producers have either been put on furlough, if they're lucky, or have just completely lost their incomes and frameworks of validation and so on and so on.
Yeah.
And thinking about their work through the lens of labor, which obviously places it in contention with ideas of labor that apply in any other industry, we kind of have to face really brutal realities of, say, supply and demand and sustainability of some of these practices.
One of the things that's become really obvious is who sustains society, first of all. You know, it's no surprise that the key workers that have been identified during the pandemic are people who are often the kind of the lowest paid. So again, my interest in kind of class relations comes into play there, but also within the art world as well, the people, it's really apparent that the people who sustain the art world are freelancers, people on 0 hours contracts. So I think, you know, the inequalities within the art world have become more apparent. It's made visible, these workers. So the people who were and were not able to apply for the funding in the first instance to kind of to maintain themselves during periods of lockdown and furlough in the UK. In terms of artistic labour, you know, people haven't had access to their own studios to make work. I imagine that there's been a lot of kind of bedroom making, you know, making at
home. That might not be that much of a change for many artists.
No. Well, of course, but I think it's at the same time that these practices have been adapting or just disappearing because of the pandemic, there's also this kind of this narrative about how creativity can help people through the pandemic. And there's this weird thing where creativity has been really valued, and, you know, things like Grayson's Art Club on TV, where Grayson Perry's inviting people to make work and send it in, it is in complete contrast to the kind of the undervaluing of the arts at the same time, you know, where funding, particularly for freelancers, wasn't there at the beginning. And people who's, and I'm not just talking about the visual arts, but, you know, the arts more widely, like sound engineers and, you know, the people who are supporting performance and gigs and festivals. And so I think the pandemic allows us to see who is sustaining and hopefully a reconsideration of how they're valued.
Well, let's get to work. We're speaking a day after the UK's toughest lockdown restrictions have been lifted. So I think there's a new hope on the horizon. Danielle Child, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Working Aesthetics, Labour, Art and Capitalism by Danielle Child is published by Bloomsbury. I'm Pierre Dalancer, and the editor is Marshall Poe. Thank you for listening, and join us next time.